I appreciate Pete reading a passage which I had no concept he was reading this morning and how it fits the morning message. One word that he said, or a verse that he read through, it says this: whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. What a picture of Ruth. And continuing in our study, I'm asking you to take your Bibles and turn with me to Ruth once again, Ruth chapter 2. We've got a couple more weeks in here in our passage for Ruth, and I'm excited for the Easter season and Resurrection Sunday, and not sure where we're going with those messages, but we will be out of Ruth in about 3 weeks. But once again, the more you study a passage like this, the more it just continues to drop out. And it was once again as the key passage that Pete read about losing your life, losing it for the Gospels, and yet that is how we save it. That is a picture of Ruth, and that's going to be a picture that you're going to see here of Boaz as he speaks to Ruth this morning. So will you stand with me, please, in reverence to God's Word and turn with Ruth chapter 2. And we're just going to be looking at three verses. We begin in verse 10 this morning and reading down to verse 13. This is what we read. Then she, Ruth, fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, Boaz, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I'm a foreigner? But Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and your mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. May the Lord add his blessings to that reading, and you may be seated. Remember in our last message, in the last couple of messages, we left this story off, this amazing scene between Ruth and Boaz. And Boaz has, at this particular point, shown her amazing kindness, and Ruth is more or less dumbfounded at it. She cannot figure out why Boaz would be showing this type of kindness to her, because really the possibility is that the gossip is going all over town that he's caught the eye of a young maiden, and they have now already instantly fell in love with one another, and maybe that's the reason, and he's showing her kindness. We can only imagine the gossip that's going around. And it really is kind of going through Ruth's idea in her mind also. Why would he be showing me all of this type of kindness that he's been? He told me to glean here, told me not to go to other people's fields. He's told me that he has ordered his men to protect me from other field workers. He's told me to stay with his own maids, his own servants in the field that are taking those shafts and binding them up. And then he's invited her to dinner, to eat and dine with them. And now he's given an amazing amount of barley to be able to take back. Oh, and by the way, I think I said last week that she actually carries 40 pounds back. I was wrong. It's closer to 30 pounds. But that's nothing compared to what next week's message. She's going to carry 80 pounds home. Ruth is no diminutive woman, by the way. Tammy and I discussed this, and she said, I am not allowed to talk about that. But she cannot be a diminutive woman. She carries 80 pounds of grain back to her family. Well, guys, just think, how far could you carry 80 pounds, let alone this woman? But this is a picture that we're going to have here of who they are. But Ruth has had an amazing kindness shown to her by Boaz. And we looked last week. It wasn't any of those reasons that he has instantly fell in love with her. There wasn't anything very special about her. She's a foreigner. She appears to be a foreigner to him. And yet she's shown amazing kindness to her. He's showing amazing kindness to her. And we recognized last week that it was in obedience. It was Boaz's obedience and his response to the grace of Yahweh in his own life. He knew the God of Israel. He knew his commands. He knew that he had to leave this field set so much and couldn't take everything out to allow for the poor to be able to glean from it. He knew all of that. And it was his personal response to the God of grace that what he was doing was extending that same grace to Ruth. And so she asked him why. And so we see this unfolding before us. But then he has a prayer for her. And that's what I want to look at this morning in verse 12. The Lord repay you. This is a prayer of Boaz for Ruth. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. It's these words that I want to look at this morning, because several of you have over the last month asked me a question which I knew was going to be raised in our minds, and that's what I want to take a look at, because I think this verse is going to explain a little bit of a conundrum, if you will, in the book of Ruth, to be able to say, why is this going on the way it's going on? Because if you remember, the first week that I preached in the book of Ruth, we looked at Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verses 3 through 6. It wasn't the passage in itself, but it set stage for it. And in Deuteronomy 23, we find very specifically the order of God given to the Israelites that they are to have nothing in essence to do with Moabites. Ruth is a Moabite. They had left and gone to the land of Moab. And so she is a Moabite, and they're to have nothing to do with it. The nation of Israel as a people are to have nothing to do with these people. He knew this. Boaz knew this verse. No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. But the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam. Instead, the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because the Lord your God loved you. You shall not seek their peace, talking about the Moabites, or their prosperity all your days forever. A Moabite, or a Moabitess in the form of Ruth, was to have nothing to do with the assembling even of the Israelites. They weren't to be welcomed into the camp. They were to be kept out. Don't even ask them to come in here into the assembly of the Lord. And he says at the very end, don't even think about making a treaty of peace or friendship with these people. That's how bad it was. That was the stern warning that we see in Deuteronomy chapter 23. And we looked at that first week that we looked at the story of Ruth. And yet we see, and it was, once again, it was part of the reason that I believe that the hand of judgment of God actually ends up on Elimelech and Naomi, in the death of Elimelech and the death of the two sons, because of the command that God has given them. But now we have almost a turnaround here. Does he not even recognize this truth? Does he not know Deuteronomy chapter 23? We know that not to be true, because we know that he's committed to the God of Yahweh. He knew the law very specifically. So what's going on with him? Why has he, in essence, turned his back on Deuteronomy chapter 23 and welcomed Ruth? And I submit to you, even welcomed Naomi back. Because think about it. Naomi has befriended this Moabitess. So why would she even be accepted back in Bethlehem at that time? Why would the mother-in-law be accepted? But yet, you see amazing kindness by Boaz being shown to Ruth at this time. So as I began to think about it, I asked, so what are we to make of this passage? What are we to make of the entire Old Testament when we look at the Israelites and we look at their appearance of being superior in so many things? The nationalism that always seems to come out of Israel, even today, and I'm not trying to take this into our time frame today, please, cannot confuse these times. Don't try to do that with this. But when we look at it, we seem to have this sense of nationalism which rises above everything else in their life. We're the Jews. We're the nation. We're God's people. Get out of our way. Absolutely nothing to do with anybody else. It's almost a sense that we throw our kindness and decency out the window when it comes to other humans, because we're the Jews. We are Israel. We are God's people. So get out of our way. And so when I began to look at this, is there a superiority? Is there a exclusivity, if you will, of the Jews, of the nation of Israel, when it comes to their treatment of other people within the world? And once again, do not take this to the year 2017. We're dealing with this in this time frame. So as I began to look at the passage this week, I've come to this conclusion, and I hope that I'm able to to explain it, but I believe partly, yes, there is a sense that partly in the earlier part of Deuteronomy, especially when the laws would have been given out, there is a sense of superiority among the Jews. We have to keep it in its proper context. We have to understand what God has commanded and what God has placed upon the nation of Israel at the time. Deuteronomy chapter 7, basically, and if you're taking notes, don't look these up. Just kind of take the notes and look them up next, because there's quite a few, or this afternoon. Deuteronomy chapter 7 tells us this, that when the nation of Israel was about to enter into the promised land, after being for hundreds of years under the bondage of Egypt, and coming out of that land, going into the promised land, the promised area that God had given to Abraham, the father of this nation, the promised area, Canaan, we call it, before they went into that, they were promised all of this, and they were to eliminate every Canaanite. If there were people in this land of Canaan, they were to eliminate them. They were to destroy them. And it wasn't a matter of simply being kind in any way, shape, or form. God had said, you will drive these people out. You will destroy these people. You won't have anything to do. You won't even consider marrying the inhabitants of this land. You'll have nothing to do with them whatsoever. And what's interesting, and we have to understand this, is why? Why would God say that to them? Was there a purpose, and did God tell us what that purpose is? We know that God does everything for a purpose, but did God tell us what that purpose is? Well, listen to Deuteronomy 7, 3 through 4. Basically, in a nutshell, it's this. He's going to tell them that it isn't so much because of your superiority, but it's because of the amazing paganism and the amazing devil worship, if you will, of these other nations is the reason that you need to drive them out, so that I have complete, undiluted, uncompromised affection and worship from you, my people. That was the purpose for what they were going to do and to drive these people out. Listen to Deuteronomy 7. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. Listen to the explicit reason here, continuing in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 4 through 6. Do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, talking to Israel, after God has thrust them out before you, don't say in your heart, it is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess this land, whereas it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations the Lord your God is driving them out from before you. And that he may confirm the word that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your rightness, for you're a stubborn people. What does that sound like? Superiority? Does that sound like you have something to run up the flagpole? Okay, I'm going to drive these people out of the land of Canaan because of their wickedness, and I'm going to use you to do it. But I need you to be a representative of what undiluted commitment is to me. And if I don't drive them out, you will become diluted. You will become non-committed to me. And so you see the purpose that all of this has been is not a matter of simply superiority because of a nation, but the reason that they're driving them out is because they have been wicked before God. Listen to Deuteronomy chapter 20. But in the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction. The Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods. And so you sin against the Lord your God. You see the purpose of what Israel was to, why they were to drive out these pagans? It was because if they didn't drive them out, then they would lead astray the people of Israel so that they would once again have this uncommitted worship of the God Yahweh. Keep this in mind. The Israelites, as you and I are today, were not able to withstand the temptations of the Canaanites in their theology or their culture, and neither can you and I today within the world. We don't have, like they don't have, any type of moral superiority about us, nor did they, to be able to resist the temptations of the Canaanites. There wasn't a moral backbone within the nation of Israel that God looked down and said, "That's my people. Look at the moral backbone of these people right here. That's who I'm choosing, angels. Pay attention to what I'm about to do because of their moral superiority." No. He says, "I have chosen you, and I will supply you the strength, and I will be your God as you worship me in the way that I am meant to be worshipped, so that I can bring down judgment. I can show my justice against the nations that have turned their back upon me." And so we see that it had nothing really to do with their moral superiority or even their nationalities. As I began to look at this, and I have to be careful with this study, because as soon as I say these words, some of us are going to say, "Give me my AR-15 because the war's on." Okay? So everybody leave your ammunition in the, hopefully in your magazines at home, but don't go shooting them. Okay? Whole new point about gun without... Anyways, I digress. But the concern that I have is I began to look at this and I started to recognize what was being said here. This is all done in the sense of holy war. There is the concept of holy war from the Old Testament. And we have to understand it in the context that it is. And once again, do not try to take that to the year 2017 in its most physical and literal sense. We can't do that. But you see in the times of the Old Testament that when it came to the Canaanites, all of these rules and all of these regulations came in the context of a holy war. Because you think about it, even Numbers, I think it's Numbers 7, I'm not quite sure, but Numbers 7 begins to talk about the army of God, that Israel is the army of God. They're even going to be setting apart. As a holy people, God has set them apart as a holy people, but he's going to set apart within those ranks any male over the age of 20 to serve in the army. They are set apart also. And think about the tribes as they are set. How do you encamp? They had specific areas that they had to encamp in. All the tribes had to. The only ones not to fight were going to be the Levites. They were the priests. They had to be the closest to the tabernacle, the very center of it. The reason that they were actually placed in a particular way, one of the reasons that they were placed in a particular way as tribes, was for quick deployment, to be able to take a unit, to be able to take a military approach to what they were doing for their own protection, and because God has given them a purpose of what they are to do. That's the picture that we see of the nation. They're a well-trained army. Now listen to this. It goes back even to a further promise than what I read in Deuteronomy. It goes back even further, back to Genesis. Because God was going to fulfill a promise that he had given to Abraham. Listen to this. Remember, the father of these people. This is what he says in Genesis chapter 15, verses 13 through 16. "Then the Lord said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they'll be afflicted for 400 years. Egypt. But I will bring judgment on that nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age.'" Listen to this. "And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet come." They had not yet tested God to the point. Their wickedness had not yet been completely filled up in God. And he says, there is a process coming. Our people will be in the nation of Egypt for 400 years in bondage and slavery. And I will bring you out. I will redeem you. I will be your deliverer. But you'll have a purpose once you come out of that. Because by that time, the Canaanites, Those that have possessed the land that I have given to you, Abraham, will have finally fed up my cup, and I will bring judgment upon them. And so you see the fulfillment of what they were actually coming out of Egypt and about to walk into in Canaan was from hundreds of years earlier, a prophecy to be fulfilled that God had given to Abraham. He said, these people will come to a particular point that they have fed up in my justice. They have been so wicked, my patience is finally done with them, that I will make a point of my justice before them. And so we see that once again, the purpose of this army of God, even in the nation of Israel, when they first come out. Think about the tabernacle, though, if you will. Where is the tabernacle to be positioned in the midst of this army? Is it an afterthought? Is it, okay, got to travel out of the army, you know, two days' journey, and we'll be able to meet with God? No, the tabernacle was center of this army. It's in the very central portion of it. And so we even have a sense from the tabernacle itself, the sacredness of God himself, even in the midst of a military deployment, even in the midst of a holy war, even in the midst of this well-trained army. And so once again, we begin to see that it isn't any superior, cunning ways of the nation of Israel that they're going to be able to outwit, outfight, outstrength, if you will, the enemy. Their assurance of victory is a theological one. Their assurance of victory is because God is on their side because of the wickedness of their enemies, and God is in the process of making point about that. At the very core of it is this. You will not die. You will not be defeated, Israel, because of the betterment of your enemies, better superiority and firepower. But you could be sabotaged by non-commitment to the Yahweh. You could be very much find yourself internally falling because of the walls inside theologically and your commitment to me and the purity that I need because you are a covenant people of mine and that you no longer live accordingly. You could find yourself in being defeated from that. It had nothing to do with your superiority as fighters. Although they were fierce, they were brilliant, but it had nothing to do with it. It had everything to do with a redeemed disposition, a submissive disposition before their God. That was reason. That is where we find the strength of the Israelites. What's also interesting as I began to look through this is that the people of Moab and the people of Midian, which is two countries just near Canaan, they were not Canaanites. The Moabites and the Midianites were not Canaanites. They were not of that people of that promised land, right next to it, but they were not part of that. And so they, theoretically, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, when you first begin the study in Deuteronomy, they were not part of the people to be driven out. Actually, there was a friendship with Moab and with the Midianites. They weren't part of that original list. However, God changes, once again, God doesn't change, he's immutable, I know that, but his perspective and their friendliness to them does change because of the fact that Moab and Midian are going to turn their backs upon God just like the Canaanites did. Because they call down a war from Baal. We looked in Deuteronomy 23, and we saw that the reason given is they have come in and they have intermarried with you, and they are in the process of leading your men astray to their pagan ways. They are doing exactly what I didn't want happen with the Canaanites, exactly what they have done, and my anger with them has filled up. It now is beginning to fill up with Moab and with Midian. And so we see them basically being added to this list to have nothing to do with them by the time we get to Deuteronomy chapter 23. It's interesting, too, as I began to think about this, and there's so much here. I'm trying to get this all in one message, but it's amazing when you begin to think about the first wave of the Israelites as they were to go into the Canaan land. God has parted the seas. He has led them across the wilderness, the short distance of the wilderness. They have come to the very edge of the Canaan land. They are about to enter into this promised land that God has hundreds of years before given to Abraham. They know that we were in slavery for 400 years. God has delivered us from it. This is the moment. This is it. All right? This is the time we were supposed to enter into that land. And what happens? They lose their edge. The edge was, as a covenant redeemed people, living in submissive covenant relationship with God, God would protect them and give them victory. And at that moment, when they're about to walk over Jordan, and they're about to walk into the Canaan land, and to take control, and to drive these people out, what happens with the spies? They lose that covenant relationship. They lose that submissive attitude toward God. They no longer believe Him. They no longer trust God in what He is about to say. It is their strength. It is the purpose and the reason that they are even there at that particular moment. And they have turned their back on it. You know what happens? God says, fine. Will you have it? This entire generation is going to die. And so for 40 years, you're going to wander around out here in the desert. You're not going to cross over. You're not going to go in and take your land. Because you people were not submissive. You were not effective in your covenant relationship with me. Not what I called you for. And so therefore, he cast judgment upon his own people for 40 years. And they wonder until the entire generation has died off. Now the second wave is about to go in under Joshua, who is one of the only people at that particular time to show faith in his commitment to the covenant relationship with God. He's about to lead them in to the land. And why? Because that generation had learned a lesson. They realized up to this particular point, we must submit to the God who has redeemed us. And we must demonstrate that with our covenant relationship with Him. And so we see that. We see they're back to this particular position of purity, of living before a covenant God. And so what we find, at least initially here in this message, is this. Israel is supposed to maintain a moral, a ritual purity before God and before the Canaanites. And because of that, they were called to eliminate the Canaanites. Their separation, the basis of the separation of the nation of Israel, has nothing to do with their nationality. It has nothing to do with their race. It has everything to do with theological reasons. That's why they weren't to have anything to do with them. Nothing about nationality and nothing about race in and of itself. It's all about theology. It's all about their commitment to the God Yahweh. That is the reason that they were called to be superior. That was the reason that they were to have the strength that they actually had. They were a message. Once again, I just don't know where all to take this message, but I will. Not only were they called to be God's army, not only are they called to have this holy war going on, but the nation of Israel is also a nation of priests. Think about it. There was a nation of priests. There was a tribe that was not to fight. But they were to try and attempt to keep the people in moral purity before God. That was their purpose at that time. And so we see them being a nation of priests even. The Canaanites have completely exhausted God's patience. But it's interesting. They're about to confirm their own depravity by God's judgment. That's what they're about to do. The Canaanites were about to confirm their own depravity before God by the fact that judgment was coming swift and fast before them. So they were in the process of confirming their own depravity. But even in the midst of that, it never, ever, ever negates God's redemptive plan to show grace to people. His judgment never, ever negates grace that He is going to show to people. And so we're going to see that unfold. Oftentimes, we talked about this at our elder meeting this weekend. So many times we have a concept, don't we, that the first two-thirds of the book is about a God of wrath and a God of justice, and then the second or the last third of the book in the New Testament more has this God of grace, and we don't see Him so much in the Old Testament. That's balderdash, as they would say in the old times. You see grace all through the Old Testament. Because in the midst of what I just explained, that here comes the nation of Israel to drive out a people who have turned their back and have completely used up any patience that God has had with them. In the midst of that, we see amazing grace. Think of Rahab. Remember the prostitute? Ooh, have nothing to do with a prostitute. Absolutely nothing. But where do the spies that go into the land, where do they hide? when they get into Jericho. They go to a prostitute's place. And what does she do? She exercises faith in the God Yahweh. Not only does she place trust and faith in the God Yahweh, but she demonstrates it by obedience even. This is a picture of true faith. From a prostitute who isn't a Jew, who is one of the people to be driven out. And yet Joshua, the book of Joshua, and Joshua himself, nowhere says brings condemnation down upon Rahab. As a matter of fact, doesn't she make Hebrews wall of faith? Think about it. The New Testament says, there's Moses, there's Abraham, there's the big ones, and there's Rahab on this list of faith people who have exercised faith. Somebody who's now in the covenant assembly. Somebody who finds themselves convinced because she had seen. If you go back and read the story of Rahab and why she hides the spies when the nation of when the Jericho leaders are coming to find them, and she hides them. Why does she talk to the spies and say, "Why I hid you?" Because I have seen the mighty works of your God. I have seen those mighty works. I have heard about the waters drying up. I've heard that you have brought down many kings by just your word at this particular point. Up to this point, we've heard that nobody is going to be able to stand before your God as a nation. I know that. I have seen his mighty works. I believe what God's promise is to you, that he is going to give you our land. That God's promise to take this land of Canaan and to give it to you Israelites is going to come true. I see his mighty works. I trust in what he is about to do. Please find favor with me and my family. There is room for Rahab in the covenant family. Think about it. A prostitute, a Gentile, but by faith. Placing faith in Jesus Christ, and you're going to see how that's going to unfold at this particular point, just faith in God Yahweh. By faith alone, there is room in the covenant family for her. Think about the Exodus itself. A little passage that many of us will skip over, and I did before I studied this. But Exodus 12:38, remember the story? God has brought plagues down upon Pharaoh and the entire Egyptians, and bad things, man, have occurred over the past months. Really bad things. And now the biggest, baddest thing has occurred. The angel of death has passed over the nation of Egypt. And everybody who didn't by faith place blood upon the door steps, didn't have on both sides of the door and on the top blood of the lamb, every family suffered death in that family. The death of their firstborn. The angel of death has occurred. They're leaving. Pharaoh says, enough. Get out. And they take amazing possessions with them as part of that fulfillment of what God has told Abraham is going to occur to them. And so in the process of leaving, there's some other people go with them. Listen to Exodus 12:38. A mixed multitude also went up with them. And very much livestock, both flocks and herds. A mixed multitude went up with the Jews when they left Egypt. Well, guess who they were? Egyptians. There were Gentiles. There were pagans that left with the Jews. And we can make, I think, a proper presumption here that these are people who heard what God was going to do and by faith did the exact same thing the Jews had done, putting the blood upon their own doors, and they were saved also from it. A mixed multitude goes up with the Jews out of Egypt. So because of their faith, Exodus 9:20, we can go there too. Then whoever feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh hurried his slaves and his livestock into the houses. Once again, we see this picture that even those Gentiles, even those particular pagans who placed trust in God Yahweh because of his previous mighty acts and the promises that they understood coming, because of placing faith in them, there was room in the covenant family for them. You're starting to see a pattern here. Go back to Abraham himself. Why was Abraham chosen? Why did God appear to Abraham? Because he had the moral backbone and the moral stamina and the moral superiority among all people for God to simply say to him, "You're the guy." He was a pagan worshiper himself. His father worshiped sun god. Presumably he did too. Nothing special morally about him. God chose to place upon him a covenant. He wasn't a cradle Christian, raised in a Christian home. He wasn't somebody who simply because he was promised certain things, he's going to come in a particular way. There was nothing special about Abraham whatsoever. But yet God does show great favor upon Abraham, choosing him out of all people to be the head of this people that he is going to show and bring into the covenant. So why is it? Basically, here's this truth. Nobody belongs to God's people simply by birth. Nobody. I don't care if you're an Israelite, I don't care if you're a Jew, nobody belongs simply because of birth. What does Jesus tell Nicodemus in the New Testament? You want to see the kingdom of God? Only one way. And that's by being born again. Nothing about your natural birth. If you want to see the kingdom of God, you must be born again. So as we begin to look at this, we look at the regeneration of the Old Testament people as compared to the New Testament. Old Testament saints believed in God's promises. They saw his mighty works. They believed his promises that the vicarious or the substitutionary atonement was going to come by constantly taking that lamb and slaughtering that lamb and having the blood put upon an altar. They understood that there was a promise that God had made because of vicarious atonement, the substitutionary atonement. The faith that they had is what saved them and placed them into a covenant relationship. And what about the New Testament? We place our faith in the blood of the Lamb who takes away the sins of the world. It's not a matter of whether you're born into a family or not, or born into a church or not. It's whether or not we have accepted what Jesus Christ has seen based upon his mighty works in our lives, and to be able to say, "I've seen it. I place my faith in what his promises are, and I know he's fulfilled it in his son Jesus Christ." So don't confuse ever the nationalism or what we see in the nation of Israel. Don't ever confuse that nationalism with covenant faithfulness. There's a major difference. It's not simply because they were Jews. It's not simply because of a nationality or a race. But it is because of covenant faithfulness that we find them placed in this covenant with God. Bottom line is this, with that, this point in my message, anyone can hear. Anyone can believe. Anyone can trust. Anyone can find room in the covenant family. We have to understand that. I know our church is a reforming church and we lean that particular way and we teach God's sovereignty. We teach predestination and we teach election. But nowhere do we find the exclusivity because of any other reason other than you hear, you repent, you trust God, you're in the family of the covenant. That's the promises of the Scripture. And we can't lose sight of that. So what about Boaz? Now we get back to the passage, okay? Now we get back to Boaz and the story of Ruth here in chapter 2 and verse 12. Why isn't Boaz disturbed about her foreignness? Why isn't Boaz disturbed about her nationality at this point? Doesn't he understand the commands of Deuteronomy 23? Doesn't he understand that you won't have anything to do with these particular people? I submit to you that he understands it very well. He understands the purpose and the meaning behind this. It's not that he didn't understand it. He understood exactly what it was saying. That there is a sense of covenant purity and moral purity and faith upon Yahweh himself that places you in the covenant. And Ruth, you are in the covenant, for everything has been told to me. Everything has been told to me about your leaving your land, about you coming here with Naomi, about you turning your back upon the pagans. You have come to seek refuge under the wings of God himself. And because of that, there is room in the covenant for you. So you're not a foreigner. You're not one that based simply upon nationality, but you yourself are in the covenant, just like Abraham turned his back on his own people when God called him and says, you'll take up out of this land and you will go to a land that I'm going to show you, and you're going to be a great people. Abraham turns his back on his family and he leaves because of faithfulness. Exactly what Ruth is doing here. Ruth has really given us a picture of the essence of true holiness. If you think about it, Ruth has given us an example of what holiness and what it should be in our lives. And this is basically it. We forsake any of the impurity of this world. We forsake and we turn our back upon any of the impurities of the Canaanites. And in our case, it's the world culture that we turn our backs on. That's the essence and the picture of what true purity actually is and true holiness actually is. And so therefore, I believe what we see here is truly the law being upheld. I think Boaz is upholding the Deuteronomy law. I believe that's the reason that you're going to see this theme fulfilled later on in the marriage of Ruth and Boaz. That all of that is being really fulfilled because it isn't a matter of nationality any longer. But it's a matter of faith. It's a matter of being placed in the covenant relationship with God. And so Ruth and Boaz, being as confident as what he is, he brings this prayer on Ruth's behalf. He brings it down and he says, I'm praying that the Lord repay you. I'm praying that the Lord reward you. For what you've done, I ask the Lord to reward and repay. Now don't be confused with this, because I was when I first started looking at it. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to what I think I'm preaching. When I looked at this, and it comes back to this, it's kind of misleading to us that God is going to somehow reward you or repay you simply because you did certain things, and now there's a relationship where you give to get, or God owes you something because of something you have actually done. That's where the misleading can come in when we look at this word repay or reward. It doesn't have anything to do with that. There isn't this relationship where saying, okay, God, I've gotten 15 good marks over here on this side, and there's only one bad mark over here in the bad side, so Lord, you owe me this much, kindness and grace. No, it has nothing to do with that type of relationship. When we understand the Hebrew and the way it was recorded here with the idea of repay or reward, it has to do with the root word of the Hebrew for shalom. We know it stands for peace, but the root word of shalom has to do with wholeness or completeness or fullness of your relationship. That's what he's talking about here. So, based upon the Holman Christian Version and Lexham Version that I use, I come up with a Guy Family translation, okay, of this particular verb. Now, I don't think I'm going to be shot, and if I don't get struck dead, I think I'm all right on this. But here's the translation of talking about what he's actually saying, using the understanding that rewarding and paying has to do with this completeness and fullness of a relationship. May God finish your work, Ruth, and may your wages find their completeness from Yahweh, God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. I actually stole that from somebody else. I had a couple little things of my own in that because I think it really paints a wonderful picture for us. May God finish your work. May God finish your work because of a relationship that you have with Him. I want to explain to you, Ruth, what this salvation package is all about. It's not a relationship where because you've entered into it, God owes you anything. But it's because you have entered into that relationship that God will bring about complete salvation for you. It's what Paul does. Remember Paul in Ephesians, coming through the New Testament, he's going to say in Ephesians 1:7, it's what Paul calls about the riches of God's grace. The riches. If you think about God's grace, if you think about it in the New Testament idea, we look upon God's grace in salvation simply as being saved from hell and spending eternity with Him in a real nice place called heaven. Well, we pretty much think what salvation is, right? Paul says that there is such a thing as about the riches of His grace. In Him we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of His grace. Theological, I think, emphasis of the same thing that we see in the Old Testament continues in Philippians. Listen to what Paul says here. And I'm sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. Your salvation package has an assurance in it, Ruth, that he who began this work is going to complete it. Therefore, 1 Corinthians, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. It isn't simply about being saved from hell. It isn't simply about knowing that I will be in this wonderful place called heaven for the rest of my life. But there is a sense in which the work that God has started involves work on your behalf, a labor on your behalf, that it isn't in vain. So Ruth, I want you to understand that what you've started, what God has started in you, in Naomi, is part of a package deal. God will bring all of this to fruition. Ephesians 2:10. For we are his workmanship, created in Jesus Christ for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. You see, Boaz is expressing an amazing hope for Ruth by calling out to God, saying, he will finish this good work in you. There is a wholeness, there is a fullness that is going to come back because he will redeem the labor of your own hands. Yeah, Ruth, there's a partnership going on here. There's a partnership between you and Yahweh. He started the work. You're the element of that right now. You're the earthen vessel that he is using. But because this work has started, there's an amazing assurance that you will be rewarded for it. I love the way it says she's seeking it under the wings of God. She is looking for, and this is the assurance that Boaz has given to her, because of your change of heart, because God has worked in you an amazing thing, bringing about a change of heart for you and a change of who you actually are and a change of lifestyle. Because of all of that, I believe that what we see here now, Ruth, is your ability to seek an amazing security. You're able to seek protection under the wings of God. Now, the Psalms are not yet written by this time, okay? Because we know that we believe that David wrote most of the Psalms. This is David's grandmother we're talking about here, so obviously these things aren't written at this particular time. But think about what David is going to write in the Psalms years later about the wings of God and the assurance that we have and the protection and the security that we have of coming under the wings of God. Psalm 36:7. How precious is your steadfast love, O God. The children of mankind take refuge in the shadow of your wings. Psalm 57:1. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me. For in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. Psalm 61:4. Let me dwell in your tent forever. Let me take refuge under the shelter of your wings. Psalm 91:4. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a buckler. It's amazing when we begin to think of the assurance that Boaz was actually communicating to Ruth at this particular time. Just like the young, the helpless chicks runs to their mother bird and finds protection under the wings of that mother bird, so you, Ruth, can run to the wings of God for your security and protection because you are in the covenant family. That's the assurance that Boaz is praying upon her. I don't care, Ruth, that life has thrown so much at you. I don't care of all the bad things that have occurred, because if we look at it just from life's perspective, there is not much gone right for you, Ruth. Okay, you have turned your back upon a family. You've come to almost a hostile people. You've lost your husband. You have a mother-in-law that you're going to have to take care of, who's bitterness of soul at this particular point. I don't care about all of that. What I know this, that you can seek refuge in the wings of God, just like the helpless chick can run to the hen, the mother hen. I believe Ruth embodies exactly what the Psalms are going to teach. While it is true, and we have to look at this, And the picture that we have, I think you guys have it up there too. I know I can see it back there. Is Ruth working? She's gleaning. She's actually in the fields, actually working and exerting her own efforts. Keep in mind that Ruth's efforts and her labor wasn't done in an issue or a mindset of self-sufficiency, ever. She didn't think it's all up to me. Because what does she say before she walks into that field? May I be, I'll find favor in some landowner who God has said you must leave so much in those fields. Landowners, you must leave so much unpicked. You must leave, not pick up the dropping that's on the ground. She was placing faith in Lord God that one of those landowners would do that. All of her efforts, all of her labor is based upon an expression of her faith that God himself was going to supply. I believe that's the assurance that we have this morning. We look back, like I say, I look at Rahab's life, I look at all of the lives. Their faith is based upon the obvious mighty acts in their life of God. What is the mighty act of God that you and I begin our journey to faith on? That we see, that we understand, that we know actually occurred. The mighty act of God was that his son, Jesus Christ, dies for us. Dies an atoning death. Dies as a sacrificial lamb, as the blood of the lamb that takes away the very sins of the world. The mightiest of all acts that God has done. We see that. And we base our faith upon that. That's where we begin that journey. We know who God is. He's in the form of Jesus Christ and what he has done on our behalf in his death, his burial, and his resurrection. We see that amazing mighty act. And then we understand that if we see that and we place the faith in his son Jesus Christ, he has given us a promise that upon that, there's room for me in the covenant family. There's room for me, a Gentile, outside the nationality. There's room for me because of the mighty acts of God and his promises to be fulfilled. And because of that, I have the assurance of all security, all protection, that I can run under the wings of my mother hen. There's always the protection given to me there. Nothing is going to affect me underneath there. God is sure he is capable of doing the mighty acts of my salvation. He is sure and he's capable of continuing my salvation. And he is good enough to do it. That's the assurance that Boaz was given to Ruth. Welcome to the covenant family, Ruth. Welcome. This is what you have. You have turned everything. You've forsaken the impurities of this world and you've turned to God Yahweh. You have forsaken everything and you exhibit holiness in your life. And because of that relationship that you now have with God, there's an amazing assurance that someday you will forever be with him. And in the meantime, you have the security of running under his shadow of his wings. I pray that that is our assurance today. I pray as we continue to look at it. Oh, by the way, next week, Ruth chapter 3 is going to have a surprise for us. I do not believe that Boaz has any concept that the prayer that he's actually praying for Ruth at this point involves him. Okay? No, I don't think he understands that. I'm going to marry that girl. Okay? I don't think he has any concept at this particular point. But it's amazing, the prayer that Boaz is going to say that there is security and there is protection under the wings of God doesn't have any concept that I'm that agent that God is going to use. But, like all Scripture, all kinds of surprises are going to come. But sufficient to say for us today, our assurance is in the fact that there was room in the covenant family for us today. And if we're there, we have the assurance of a mother hen protecting in security of those wings.